Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston. Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'm going to be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the major stories making the news here in Ireland and around the world in business and in politics. Coming up on today's show, we'll be talking to the Irish entrepreneur Paul Barrett. He's recently made the headlines in Forbes magazine for spearheading a record-breaking investment in a groundbreaking hydrogen project in Australia. And then it's all politics, really, because we'll be looking into the Reform Party in the UK. Philip Webster, former political editor of The Times, will be joining me for that. And then Belgium is divided and increasingly being pulled into political extreme areas. Laura Dubois is the editor of the Europe Express for the Financial Times, and she'll be joining me on the line to discuss what's happening there. And here at home, just how significant are the upcoming local, European and mayoral elections in Limerick, really? Law lecturer Jennifer Kavanagh will be joining me here in studio to give us her views on what's at stake for the political players next week. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. So first up today, let's start with that story from Down Under.
Now, recently, Forbes magazine had a story about an Australian startup called Hysata, which has just banked the biggest round of investment for a climate tech startup in Australia. The CEO of that company is an Irish man. His name is Paul Barrett, and he joins me on the line from Australia to talk about the company and its future. Paul, you're very welcome to News Talk. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Mandy, great to be here, and I look forward to the conversation.
Now, congratulations on securing such a significant investment for Hysata, but you might start us off today by telling us a little bit about yourself, the company, how you ended up in Australia and what it is that Hysata does.
So yeah, originally from Dublin, schooled and university educated in Dublin, and I moved to the US in the early 2000s, spent about 8 years there, using my technical background in chemical engineering, and moved to Australia in about 2008, and was always in kind of startup, entrepreneurial type roles. And I founded Hysata about 3 years ago with a couple of my co-founders. And this was technology that's really transformational for green hydrogen production. And green hydrogen is a really vital energy vector on the path to net zero. And so on the path to net zero, we've got to electrify everything. So that's electric cars, electric heating at home, heat pumps, electric hot water. But there's a lot of hard to abate sectors that are difficult to electrify. These are industries like steel, chemical manufacture, high grade industrial heat, and heavy transportation. And they're markets that Hysata is ideally placed to provide, highly efficient produced and low cost green hydrogen.
Mm. And we'll get into the technology around all of that and what you do in a moment. But tell us about this fundraising round. It seems to have been a massive success. Tell us about what you did and the success of that and what it will allow your company to do now.
Yeah, so firstly, it was a huge team effort. So I get to speak to you here today, but I have a really incredible team of 75 people, and we're just south of Sydney in an iconic beachfront location. And so, teamwork, collaboration, and, really strong execution brought this capital raise together. And this capital raise was underpinned by, you know, those foundations, as I mentioned, really world-class team. We've got this highly differentiated technology, and we've got huge commercial traction for our product. And all those ingredients brought together a really incredible investment round where we've assembled, you know, the financial might of world-leading financial investors, coupled with the big balance sheet and engineering capability of major strategic. So I've kind of got a pinch yourself cap table or list of investors that we've brought together.
And how much did you actually raise, Paul?
So we raised, it depends what currency you ask me. So it was 172 million Aussie dollars, which is 111 million US, which I think is 105 million euro.
Well, that's not bad by any standards, no matter what currency you're looking at. And maybe we'll go back to the actual technology and the energy itself. Before we get into what you do, there's always a lot of talk when you're talking about hydrogen, whether it's blue hydrogen or green hydrogen, that it's tremendously expensive to develop. Why is that?
So if you look, I have to give you a little bit of a background of the technology, but I'll keep it high level. So an electrolyzer is a machine that splits water, and water is H2O, and it splits it into hydrogen and oxygen using electricity. So the biggest cost in generating green hydrogen is actually the electricity. It's about 75 to 80% of the cost. And it's really only in the last 5 or 6 years, as the cost of renewables have continued to decline, so that's the cost of wind and solar panels, that it starts to make green hydrogen economic. And so what HySat has done is we're bringing to the market a big step change in electrical efficiency, an electrolyzer that takes 20% out of the electrical cost. And then by extension, it really sort of redefines the economics of green hydrogen production.
Mm. So it's that electrolyzer technology that you're developing. And do you see the development of this going global for you? Do you see that it actually could contribute to the wider decarbonization and the hydrogen industry more globally beyond what's happening in Australia?
Yeah, absolutely. So firstly, when you're in Australia, there's a bit of tyranny of distance, so you've really got to think commercially, globally since inception, and that's really where we've been focused on. We've got a part of our commercial team, obviously in Australia, but also in Europe, in Denmark, and also in the US. So these are huge global commercial and decarbonization opportunities, and the sectors we're going for account for about 20% of the world's emissions. So yeah, green hydrogen is a major energy vector to decarbonize those hard to abate sectors.
Mm. And I've read a lot of the interviews that you've done. You talk a lot about mass marketing and supply chain optimization. How do you plan to use those specific work streams to try and accelerate the development of the hydrogen solutions that you're offering on a larger scale? Do you use Australian manufacturing? Do you try and nearshore everything? What do you do to try and maximize those two areas?
Yeah, so part of our company DNA is not only this high efficiency, but it's designed for mass manufacturability. So when you look at getting a company to scale, you can't just have a great idea or a great invention. It's really got to be mass manufacturable. Mm. And that's the design thesis we brought together right from inception. And I have assembled a stellar team. My chief engineer has a background in not only electrolysis, but also in mass manufacture, where he worked at Apple for their mass manufacturing, you know, a million units a day of components. So you have to have that mindset from inception and ensure that you're not only your design, but your supply chain. And your supply chain is your materials, your manufacturing equipment, and the partnerships you'll forge are kind of all in place. So we've got a design architecture that's really suited to hyperscaling. And hyperscaling is maybe more a term for software, but we've really got a unique and simple to manufacture material set that positions us really well for high quality mass manufacture and really quickly.
Paul, you keep mentioning your team, and it's an admirable trait that you don't hog all the limelight for yourself or try and claim all the success. I mentioned the Forbes magazine article. I also read an article in the Currency platform that you did, and you talked a lot about your team there as well. One of the things that you mentioned in that, what I thought was very interesting, was to try and develop the team as a whole. I've worked over the years with many, many engineers, and whilst they're really good at what they do, they can be sometimes emotionally unintelligent, if you like, when it comes to workplace and trying to get a team together who gels well is a very important part of such a big project like this, I'd imagine. How did you go about doing that?
And I'd reiterate that this, while the technology gets the headlines, it's the team that transforms this into a real business. And we've got a multidisciplinary, multicultural team, and we've got to speak a common language, and I've got to have a common set and framework around communication and collaboration. And we really invested early. I've done this a few times at different companies. So we brought in a chief people officer super early in the company to help us build and maintain those cultural foundations and roll that out through training and leading by example. And I think that's worked really well, and we're continuing to invest in our people to help them grow and collaborate. And this is all about collaboration. When people come together, it's always 1 + 1 = 2. So we really foster that collaboration, communication, respect, honesty and integrity, empathy and kindness in a high-performance team, because we're results-driven, but we've got to have that teamwork that sits behind it.
Absolutely. Paul, you mentioned some sectors that you're targeting specifically. Are there any real-world applications of the technology that you're using at the moment, or what sectors are you kind of focusing on for the future?
Yeah, so if you look at some of those shareholders, strategic investors we've brought to the table, we have BP and Petronas, which are two oil and gas majors. We have POSCO, which is a Korean steel company, one of the biggest steel companies in the world. And we have Vestas, which is the world's largest wind turbine company headquartered out of Denmark. So we're collaborating with all those strategic partnerships and other blue-chip customers as we bring this technology to scale. So the first use cases where there's major decarbonization impact and major commercial demand is those sectors I mentioned, that steel, chemical manufacture, high-grade industrial heat, and heavy transportation. And, there's a big decarbonization opportunity, as I mentioned, around that 20% of world emissions in those sectors. But the commercial opportunity is also off the charts. This is a multi-trillion dollar opportunity for electrolyzers on the path to net zero in 2050. So it's exciting to get out of bed to not only decarbonize, but chase and take major market share in such a big opportunity.
Absolutely. You're surely in the sweet spot. Like you mentioned, BP and Petronas there, those massive majors themselves wanting to transition, having to transition. And so this seems a very timely development from your perspective. I just wanted to move closer to home for a moment, Paul, to get your views on Ireland, if I can. We're having a lot of energy security difficulties here, or certainly conversations around decarbonisation. There's a quasi-moratorium on data centres, and so our supply chain in terms of energy is in the mix for discussion. Have you any plans to come home here and solve any of our problems, or what do you think of the Irish situation?
Well, I think Ireland is doing super well. It is one of the leading lights in the world, particularly around wind. We have about 30% of the grid in Ireland is wind. And I think, South Australia and probably Ireland are the two jurisdictions that have done really well at integrating wind, which is a variable resource, in a reliable way into a grid. So I think there's huge opportunity for Ireland, being a small island with a magnificent set of territorial waters off the west coast, to double down and do a lot of offshore wind. And then with a lot of offshore wind, we can create a oversupplied grid in Ireland that creates more electricity that Ireland needs. And then what do you do with those electrons? So firstly, you would lower the power bill for the people in Ireland, but then you would open up those industries like data centers, but also green hydrogen to make value-added green products for export. So I think there's a huge opportunity for Ireland to take its seat as the Emerald Isle or the green energy, the Emerald Isle green energy superpower, and leverage all that offshore wind to do a lot of clever things for the economy.
Paul, finally, before I let you go today, look, we brought you on here to talk about your success in the fundraising effort and the investment series that you had in Australia. What will that significant investment allow your company to do right now?
Yeah, so on the pathway to creating a era-defining company, there's many milestones, and we've celebrated many of those with the team. But one of the biggest ones is getting the capital to do it. So this is a move-the-needle amount of capital with a transformational list of shareholders. And we're using that capital wisely, moving swiftly to scale this technology and get this product into the field, into the hands of customers, you know, generating obviously high margin revenue and deeply decarbonizing those hard to abate sectors.
Well, Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today, and thank you for joining us from Australia. That was Paul Barrett, CEO of Hysata. And if you want to read more about Paul, you can do so in Forbes magazine or The Currency. Paul, thank you very much for being with us today.
Much appreciated. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to News Talk's Taking Stock. Belgians are heading to the polls on the 9th of June for a general election, and we'll be looking at the political landscape with Laura Dubois from the Financial Times after this short break.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, in this year of crucial elections taking place right across the world, we might have overlooked one that's taking place quite near to home, as well as its local and European elections. Belgium goes to the polls on the 9th of June for its general election, and it looks as if both the far left and the far right are set to make huge gains. What might that mean for the country and indeed for Europe in a wider sense? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Laura Dubois, who is the editor of Europe Express from the Financial Times. Laura, like, just to put a bit of context on this election for us, we might start by reminding our listeners about the configuration of politics in Belgium, because it's quite complex already. Just set out how the current government is formed and the complexity of that.
Yeah, so Belgium is a bit of a complicated country because it's divided sort of linguistically and ethnically into different regions. So we've got French-speaking Wallonia and Dutch-speaking Flanders, and then Brussels, the capital, which is sort of its own little region. And all of the parties, except one actually, are regional parties. So when voters go to the polls, on the 9th of June, they will be voting for their regional parties, which then have to come together to form a national government. So it's really quite complicated because sometimes the parties don't speak the same languages, even though they may have similar political affiliations. So Belgium has a bit of a history for having chaotic government formations. And the current government actually is a 7-party coalition that took office after almost 500 days of negotiations. So I guess next time we can expect something similar.
Yeah, and you look, European politics is increasingly fragmented. Maybe Belgium is perhaps more used to this type of division because of its construct. But what are Belgians voting for in the general election? How many seats are up for grabs? And I just wanted to tease out a bit about how Belgians vote, because I understand that registered voters are obliged to vote in that country.
Yeah, that's true. Voting is mandatory. So if you don't vote, maybe you can get a fine. And what they will be voting for is the Federal Assembly, which has 150 seats. So it will be filled with these different regional parties. So we've got, for example, the Socialists in Wallonia, the Parti Socialiste, but then we also have the Socialist Party in Flanders, which is called Vooruit. And so depending on where you live, you really choose your regional party, which will then be sitting in the federal parliament.
Mm. Now, I suppose, you know, we want to talk today about who might shake up the election on the 9th of June. So maybe take us through the two parties from the left and the right who are threatening to shake up the natural order.
Yes, absolutely. So Belgium is interesting because we've got both the far right and the far left, which are sort of making gains, as you said. And the front runner at the moment is Vlaams Belang, which is a far right sort of nationalist party in Flanders. And they are currently leading the polls and are set to win 26 out of the 150 seats. So they would be the biggest party in parliament. And it's interesting because their agenda is very Flemish.
Mm.
They, for example, campaign for independence, and their goal is for Flanders to become an independent state, which obviously makes it a difficult coalition partner. And all of the other parties also have historically said they don't want to form a coalition with the far right. So that's one thing. And then we also have the far left, which is the Workers' Party, which is the only party that's represented in all Belgian regions. And depending on what polls you look at, they could become the second or the third largest force in the national parliament and win sort of 19 or 20 seats. So they could also become quite an important force.
So given the, I suppose, the traction that the VB party are getting on that Flemish side, am I right in thinking that, albeit that they're successful and that they're gaining traction, it doesn't seem that, because of their policies and how extreme they are, doesn't seem that they will be part of a coalition? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it sort of looks like that, because there's been this sort of historical, it's called cordon sanitaire, sort of a sanitary cordon, sort of gentleman's agreement between all other parties not to govern with them. But there is one other party, the NVA, which is also Flemish and nationalist, which has sort of been toying with the idea of governing with them. But quite recently, actually, its party leader, Bart De Wever, has come out and said he will probably not form a coalition with them. So it looks like even though they're the biggest party, or they will be the biggest party, they will probably be relatively isolated, and the other parties will end up forming a government without them.
Right, so that's in a government sense. What about at regional level? If they're, you know, gaining that traction and attracting more voters at regional level, could they be more powerful there after the local election, say?
Yeah, that could be the case. There is actually, there will be municipal election this year as well. They will be a bit later in October, but there is obviously the Flemish Parliament as well, which voters will also vote for on the 9th of June. So they could be more influential there. And, well, it remains to be seen. The NVA could also change their mind again and decide that they do want to do a local coalition with Vlaams Belang and Flanders. But this would also then impact the federal negotiations. And, for example, the Socialists have already said if NVA governs with Vlaams Belang and Flanders, they don't want to govern with them on the federal level.
Mm.
So the two negotiations will kind of impact each other because they will be happening in parallel.
And what are they campaigning on? Is immigration a big part of the election there in Belgium?
Yes, absolutely. Vlaams Belang is campaigning on an anti-immigration ticket. They want to reduce immigration. And I've also met some of the voters of Vlaams Belang, and they kind of say that that's a very important issue for them, that they feel that the mainstream parties are not really listening to their concerns when it comes to immigration. And, that they just want to stop people coming to Belgium, basically.
Very interesting, though, that they're so popular with the people, and they're obviously going to gain a lot in the elections, but by the sounds of things, the other parties will do everything to keep them out of government and ruling because of those extreme policies. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to News Talks Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, and I'm speaking with Laura Dubois, who is editor of Europe Express at the Financial Times. So we're talking about the upcoming election in Belgium. Laura, I want to turn to the other side now, if we can. Wallonia, maybe just explain to us all the configuration there. They're more far left and left leaning.
Exactly. So Wallonia has been traditionally a stronghold of the left. So the Socialist Party is very strong there, and they have been historically also because Wallonia sort of was an industrial region. It was like the first industrial region on the European continent after the UK, the first to industrialize. So it has a very strong workers' movement. And so for example, when you speak to voters there, a lot of them say that they are traditional socialist voters, come from the working class, etc. But there also the far left has been gaining strength, the Workers' Party, and they are a bit more extreme than the Socialist Party. And both are sort of campaigning on, you know, a tax for the wealthy and more redistribution, these sort of traditional left-wing policies. But the Workers' Party is just a bit further to the left.
Mm. And you mentioned there that there's a party who's campaigning across the geographical split, if you like.
Yes, exactly. So the Workers' Party is also polling double digits in Flanders, interestingly, and also in Brussels, which is why they are set to make such strong gains in the federal parliament, because they are sort of represented in the whole country, as opposed to these other parties, which are only regional.
Mm. And look, those gains that are made or will potentially be made by the far left and the far right, how might that affect Belgium's place and Belgium's place in Europe?
Well, I think the biggest effect will be that we will have very long coalition negotiations, because there will be a lot of back and forth between all the different parties. Who will be sitting with who? Will there be potential coalitions, etc.? I mean, the far left has also said that they will probably not enter a federal government because they don't want to compromise on their core policies, which, for example, excludes them governing with, for example, the Liberal parties, which are economically have very different views. But I think in general, this trend of populist parties gaining strength is in line with what's happening in a lot of other European countries. For example, in the Netherlands, where we've now seen a populist government forming, also in France, the far right is polling very strongly ahead of the European elections, in Germany as well. So it seems like this is just a European trend in a way.
Mm. Laura, how would you categorise the kind of mood music around this? Is this election seen, obviously there's a great deal of uncertainty about what will happen afterwards, but is it seen as a kind of dangerous time for the country?
Well, it's strange because Belgium has been so used to long government formations and to being fragmented that in the way when you speak to Belgians, a lot of them say, well, this is just what we're used to and we will find a way whatever happens, because Belgium has always find a way to govern itself. But at the same time, there is this feeling that Vlaams Belang, the far right, has never had quite so many seats in parliament and has really never polled as strongly. So some people are saying, well, let's see where this is going to go. It is a bit more extreme than it used to be.
Mm. Well, certainly very interesting to hear the background of it. And look, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today to explain what is a very complex political landscape. That was Laura Dubois, who is the editor of Europe Express at the Financial Times. It's a weekday newsletter on European affairs. Laura, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock on News Talk. Coming up, turning to the UK elections on July the 4th, we'll be looking at the Reform Party in the UK. And law lecturer Jennifer Kavanagh joins me to look at what lies ahead in the local, European and mayoral election in Limerick.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with privacy mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course. Present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Next week. Welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, the UK Reform Party might have been slightly taken off guard by Rishi Sunak's announcement of an election last week, but the party's now polling in double digits. And we're going to look today at how it might shape the general election that's due to take place in July in the UK. But who are the Reform Party and why are so many one-time Conservative supporters giving them their backing? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Philip Webster, the former political editor of The Times. Philip, you're very welcome to Taking Stock. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
Now, just the very basics. Who exactly are the Reform Party and what was their origins and what do they stand for?
Well, you used to know them as UKIP. And after that, you might have known them as the Brexit Party. And now they're the Reform Party. But I've always said that if there were two politicians in Britain who were responsible for Britain leaving the European Union, they were David Cameron and Nigel Farage, the president now of Reform and still the big name in Reform. And Cameron called that referendum back in 2016 because he was scared of Farage. At that time, UKIP were making big advances in the polls, also in by-elections. They took a couple of seats, and Cameron thought the only way to see off this challenge on the right of politics was to call that referendum and let the country sort it out. He thought it would be a big majority for Remain. He got it wrong. So nobody should ever underestimate how important Farage has been to British politics.
Interesting that both of those gentlemen are still involved on the margins, if not centrally. But Farage, I think, more so is, if you like, the puppet master behind Reform UK, or it certainly seems from this distance. Am I right? He's never been actually elected to Parliament in the UK, and he's not standing this time. But why not? Why hasn't he jumped into the Reform Party and taken it and his opportunity to finally see off the Conservative Party when they are in such dire straits now?
Well, what he said it today, actually, was that had the election being in the autumn, he would have stood. Now, it's very easy to say that now. He said he was looking at three constituencies with a view to standing there. Now, I think he will play a big role in the campaign. He is doing so already. Clearly, had he been standing, he would have been stuck in one constituency trying to win that seat. He has won a European seat in the past. If you remember, mm-hmm. a few years back, UKIP did very well in the European elections. So he has been elected, but he's never been elected to a Westminster seat. So I think what's going to happen now is you're going to see him everywhere. He's going to, the BBC have just announced that he's going to appear on Question Time quite shortly. That's caused a bit of a row, actually, as to why he should be on and not the actual leader of Reform, a man called Richard Tice, who the country doesn't know particularly well. So Farage has been around already. He was there today when they launched their employer immigration tax, expecting that employers in the UK who hire overseas workers on very cheap wages will have to pay more national insurance for those workers. Now, he was there. He's around everywhere at the moment. He keeps telling everyone he's far more interested in the election of Trump in America. But I think we're going to see quite a lot of him in the next 5 weeks.
It's such a strange situation, Philip. Like, he's a political celebrity. Maybe he's afraid of standing in a constituency. Yes, certainly that would confine his time there. Maybe he's afraid of losing and losing his potency as an electoral asset to them. But ultimately, what I wanted to ask you is, and yes, he's been involved in every iteration of this party, beyond all that they've done in relation to Brexit, how electorally successful have they been? And, you know, we look at the damage that they've done. We look at the damage they've done to the Conservative Party in moving them further to the right. But electorally, how successful are they?
They haven't been really. I mean, their impact in this election will probably be to give Keir Starmer a bigger majority than he would otherwise have had. Mm. When you look at the breakdown of voting patterns among age groups, the over 50s are far more likely to vote Conservative under normal circumstances. The number of under 50s who are voting Conservative, I saw a poll yesterday, had them down in the teens, which is very, very low. Now, the problem for the Conservatives is that if you are a Conservative over 50, the polls show that you are far more likely to opt for Reform because you like their policies. So Reform may, in some seats, get, you know, who knows, 15, 16, 17%. That will certainly be enough to stop the Conservative winning, and it may well let Labour in. So they have this indirect effect on the British election. You're right about Farage. I think were he to be standing this time, he would find it very difficult to win in a general. He'd probably get the top mark for a Reform candidate, but I doubt whether he'd win. And of course, then the magic would go because he would have been right at the centre of British politics, and he'd given this big chance and he'd failed. But they have, as I said before, they have won by-elections way back now, particularly in the Essex area. They won two by-elections way back. And that's as far as it's gone. They'd never had any kind of success in a general election when the turnout in the UK tends to be over 70%.
Mm. What about their policies now? What is their offering to the electorate?
they still campaign on the case of getting a real Brexit. They claim that what we're living through at the moment is not a real Brexit, and they claim that were Starmer to take over, he would undoubtedly soften our relations with the European Union. He's right there, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, Starmer will seek to open up avenues with the European Union. But they campaign very much on Europe and immigration. Immigration is their big policy. As I mentioned today, they've announced that they don't often go in for policies. They don't have much of a manifesto. But today they've announced this employer immigration tax. And some people will quite like that, and they'll actually go out and vote for that. They don't like the idea of cheap labour in some seats, particularly in the summertime when quite a lot of people come over from other countries and pick our fruit up in Lincolnshire and places like that. So they will get a bit of support for that policy. I don't anticipate seeing anything other than let's get a proper Brexit done being their slogan as they go through the campaign.
Yeah, I had a look at around their website today, and one of their promises was that they would scrap all the woke nonsense. How much thought has gone into that policy? I just want to examine a little bit the party itself beyond Farage, how it's funded, because I was looking at some of the figures there, and what they were raising in 2019 before the election then was like around 7.5 million, and the last donations published by them in 2023 was 250,000. So it seems that maybe some of the big backers have gone, or how are they doing financially?
I don't think they're awash with funds. They do get backing from right-wing groups in the UK and outside. I believe they do get some backing from right-wing groups based in the United States. They obviously don't need as much as some of the other parties, although they are committed to getting as many candidates as possible. They said at the start they were going to try and get somebody in every seat. I doubt very much whether they've got enough candidates for that. And candidates know that they've really got to put up quite a bit of their own cash to get through this 5-week campaign. But yes, they are funded by right-wing policy groups, right-wing think tanks. It's enough for them, certainly, to get by, but their long-term hope, which we really haven't gone into yet, is that if the Tory party is decimated in the coming election, will the Tory party then go further to the right, and will there then be a new attractive leader in somebody called Nigel Farage? That's not beyond the realms of possibility in the mind of some people. Certainly, I know some Conservative MPs who believe that Sunak is much too much in the centre of politics. They want to go much further. I'm thinking of the likes of Suella Braverman, the former Home Secretary, who's absolutely criticised the government's current stance on immigration and says the Rwanda policy won't work and it's far too soft. So there are people in the Conservative Party, and I mean MPs who are going to get re-elected, who would be much in favour of the party moving ideologically and practically to the right. So there is that possibility that hangs around for post-election.
Yeah, and we'll recall the reception that Nigel Farage received when he attended the Tory party conference. And yes, indeed, Liz Truss's efforts to lean more into his agenda and how disastrous that all turned out for them. But just maybe focus a little bit for a second, if I can, on Richard Tice, who is the de facto leader of the party. Who is he, and how important is he in the structure of the party now and the party itself? Like, one of the things that strikes me is that it wasn't ready, it wasn't prepared, the funding doesn't seem great. Do they have a robust party structure?
No. I mean, in the past, they've often fallen apart when put under the spotlight. And you can be absolutely sure, I could bet you now, that several of their candidates will have to stand down during the election for coming out with remarks that most reasonable people would consider to be racist. And at that point, Richard Tice, who's he's been in the party for quite a long time, businessman, he's been a disciple of Farage for quite some time. But at that point, when the candidates step out of line, even the reform leadership will have to take action against them. And it's happened in all recent elections. It happened when they were called UKIP. It happened when they called the Brexit Party. And you can be absolutely sure that reform won't necessarily have totally reformed.
Yeah, we're getting quite conditioned to it. Just final word, Philip, if I can. How do you think they'll do in these elections?
I think they'll be in the very low teens. And in some constituencies, and I'm thinking of seats in Essex, which have traditionally been fairly right-wing when it comes to the question of immigration, their vote may well go up to 16-17%. And when it reaches there, they are doing real damage. At the moment, their vote is hovering around the 10%. Some polls show it at 8, some polls show it at 12. Now, if Farage is going to play as big a role as appears likely at the moment, that can only swell their vote. And when they start getting up to 13, 14, 15, 16, that's a serious problem for Rishi Sunak.
And Philip, yeah, they're often seen as a fringe party, but as you have quite rightly articulated there, they have, you know, more than their fair share of affecting the mainstream political landscape. Philip, thank you very much for taking the time to explain all of that to us today. That was Philip Webster, former political editor of The Times. Thank you. Now, finally today, we're just a week away from the European local and, in the case of those of you who are living in Limerick, the mayoral elections. And just in case you weren't sure of how and why we're holding these, I'm delighted that Jennifer Kavanagh, the law lecturer at Southeastern Technical University in Waterford, is here with me in studio to talk all things election. Jennifer, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me. One of my favourite times of the year whenever there's an election.
Absolutely. We're total anoraks, a pair of us. You might start us off by explaining what you think the importance of these upcoming elections are, because we often hear, particularly about the local elections, that they don't really matter. They don't really predict what might happen in a general election, but they're important, aren't they?
Absolutely. And get out and make your voices heard. That's the main thing, because people need to turn up and vote. So with the local elections, there's always more independence because there will be local issues, there will be local personalities and characters who are putting themselves forward. It is important for the parties because at the end of the day, it's the local councillors and the network around them that will be the people canvassing in the general election. So when it comes to the Europeans, then obviously so much more of our laws and the major policy areas are all being shaped by Europe. It even comes down to who ends up being the president. A lot of people are looking at Ursula von der Leyen, and particularly from our Irish perspective on Palestine. A lot of people may not be in favour of that. But remember, she gets her vote from the people that we elect in as MEPs. Mm. So things like fisheries, agriculture, environment, this is a lot more driven by Europe than anywhere else. So the one thing is, what really annoys me about this is national issues get conflated into what's going on in local and Europeans. Mm. So always bear in mind that when people are saying, I'm running in the European elections because I want the government to do this in Ireland, wrong election, lads. So bear that in mind. So no, I even say this to my students, that some people will vote for a certain party because that's the way their parents have always voted. Some people might vote a certain way because their husband or their wife, who they think knows more, is voting a certain way. But go and read what they are saying. And if that resonates with you, doesn't matter what umbrella they're running under or no umbrella, that's the person you should be voting for. Now, the weird one, well, it's not weird. This is not any disrespect on Limerick people, but it's the mayoral election will be very interesting. So the backstory to that is, at the last European and local elections, there was a plebiscite for both Limerick, Waterford and Cork. Do you want a mayor? Waterford said no, Cork said no, but Limerick said yes. So now we're at the time now voting for the candidates. Because we've never had an election like this, it's going to be interesting to see what way it goes. You know, there's probably runners and riders that are probably earmarked already as the favourites, but to see what way it works out, because this mayoral idea is going to be rolled out more. Personally speaking, Dublin should have been first, because you can't have a number of different councils fighting over what's happening in Dublin. You need a central body for that. Mm. So this will be a very good testing ground to see what will happen for Dublin down the road.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting, I suppose, about Limerick as well. Look, it's very important for Limerick. It's interesting that they chose to go down this route. Not everyone's in favour of even having an election for a mayor. My former boss, Bertie, is certainly not one who thinks that this is the way to go. But we will see, won't we, whether or not this is something that's embraced and whether the people come out to vote on this issue. If Limerick has a higher turnout, maybe we'll learn that actually this is something people are interested in. And of course, when the mayor is in situ and it is directly, they are directly elected, we'll then be looking at how that directly elected mayor compares to the ones who are not.
Correct. And it will also be interesting to see, just particularly from Limerick, how many people vote for the Europeans, the locals, and possibly spoil their vote as a protest. Mm. So even people, I remember with my own mother, that when they're on about bringing the electric voting machines, she was saying, how do I spoil my vote? And I just said, well, press every button, break the machine. So spoiling your vote does actually give a message as well. Mm. And bear in mind, it's very easy to accidentally spoil your vote. Mm. So make sure that you understand what way you're voting. Please don't do a Kerry and do one on two different ballot papers, or do one on one ballot paper and then continue your numbers down and across onto the local elections. If anyone is unsure of the mechanics, the Electoral Commission has a very good website.
Yeah, they've done a lot of good work, haven't they, in trying to inform people about it. Interestingly, we were talking earlier in the programme about elections in Belgium, and I was interested to learn there are 21 countries where voting is mandatory if you're registered as a voter on the electoral system. So it is really important that people get out, isn't it? If you're not registered already, is there anything you can do, or is it too late?
Probably at this stage it would be too late. And also, even if you wanted a postal vote or even special voters, they would be people in long-term nursing home or hospital care, there is a mechanism for them to vote, but the time limits are pretty much gone for that. So if you're registered, if you're not sure, and you, a lot of the postal, the ballot information cards have gone out from the local councils. So if you haven't got one, you don't have to have one to vote. So go on to check the register or the various different websites. I know Dublin has, was voting.ie or something that they were advertising. But go on to check the register, double check if you haven't received that polling information card, because if you're on the register, it will even have the booth number there for you.
Exactly.
And they can ask for ID. So always make sure you have something with you, because they are entitled to check that you are who you are voting.
Yes. I want to go back to the European elections for a minute. I think there is a growing appreciation that a lot of our regulations and laws are coming out of Europe, and that the MEPs in previous elections may have been an afterthought and people pay more attention to what's happening locally. But with the prevalence and prominence of people like Francis Fitzgerald and all the other Irish MEPs who we see making contributions in the Parliament, I think there's a growing recognition that these are important. What constituencies should we be looking out for here, particularly in relation to the European elections? What would be interesting?
The first thing to say is always check as well who they're aligned to in the grouping in the Parliament, because you might be voting for a certain party, but you may not realise who they are in the different groups with in Europe. So do check that. Also do check who their substitutes are.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because candidates don't often lean on that or promote that even in the same way they do at a domestic level.
Yes, because it's like being an independent in the Dáil that's unaligned. There's not really much even speaking time you can get. So that is important. When it comes to the constituencies, I think they're all going to be interesting, to be honest, because there's such a large slate of candidates from so many parts of the spectrum of political thought.
Yeah, maybe go back a bit, actually. Just how many seats do Ireland have now?
Oh, well, I'm looking particularly at Ireland South, because that is my one and that's five. There is an extra seat, I believe, gone into what I consider the rest of Ireland constituency. And then there is the Dublin one, I believe, Laois Offaly has moved as well.
That's right.
The old demarcation used to be the Galway-Dublin motorway. So for Laois Offaly people, just remember that you are being put in with a different group. So my biggest relief, though, with the European election this time is there's no Brexit seats. Mm. If you remember, they were looking at a recount in Ireland South that could have gone on for 28 days. I mean, I love politics. I love counts, but that would even be too much for me. So they're all going to be interesting, because the way that it's going to break down with some of the MEPs retiring, who's going to come in, that will probably give a better signal towards the general election, because obviously with the Europeans, you're looking at such a large constituency, the party machine does count. Mm. So it would be very hard for a very unknown independent to take the seat.
Why do you think that the local elections are not seen as a barometer of how parties will do in the general election? Is it because people are largely voting on the people they connect with locally? Yeah.
Exactly. So you do see independents doing very well. Like in Waterford, we had Davy Daniels, who's now passed, but his son is running in the election. But for example, he would have been the longest running councillor continuously elected in, but a complete independent. Mm-hmm. So it is an awful lot down to who is known in the area, who is out and about. And the normal one of, I remember, was a very good meme. It was a cat looking at you like desperate for milk, like, please vote for me. And then it was the cat then from Shrek, who couldn't even look at anyone once they got elected in. So as well as that, it is a very good platform for people who do want to run then in the general election, because they're getting a sense of how things work. Mm. Because bear in mind, with the last general election, you would have had a lot of new TDs coming in who would have been councillors. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like sometimes with the parties, they might even look on it as an apprenticeship route. Start the locals, work your way up and see how it pans out. The biggest thing, though, with the local elections, I have complete respect for anyone who goes for the local elections. I know of some councillors whose kids won't even go with them for a bottle of milk into the supermarket, because you're not just getting a bottle of milk, you're being canvassed.
Yes,
so it takes about 2 hours. So people are putting themselves out there, and they're in the local community, they are very accessible. So I have a lot of respect for anyone who goes for local politics.
Jennifer, you've already established that you're a complete anorak and nerd when it comes to these things. I just wanted to ask, what campaigns you've looked at, how do you think the various parties have performed in these elections? Particularly, I suppose, what I wanted to look at was the campaigns in the context of social media and digital campaigning. Have you noticed any difference? Because this is the first time, really, when they're out and about and alive online.
So I have noticed an awful lot on Instagram. I'm pretty much not on any other social network now at this stage, that you're seeing a lot more about the ad was paid for by a certain candidate. But I have to say, the funniest video online I have seen now this morning, and it's Reggie from the Blackrock Road.
Very clever.
And the candidate's name is escaped
John
me.
Mullins, is it?
Yeah, that's exactly who it is. Yeah. And as we know, Reggie has a 6.4 million mansion on the Blackrock Road, and he's realised this guy's a Nari and will be everywhere else, so vote for him to get him out of South Cork.
Yeah, yeah, clever.
I think it's one of the cleverest ones that I have seen of recent.
And how is that regulated? That was what I was wondering. Is there somebody who's actually analysing all this to see if there's balance? And
yeah, so with the Electoral Reform Act that came in, there was specific provisions to look at online advertisements. Now, it's caught in a quandary at the moment, because Europe is coming out with their own legislation on it. The duties that would have been there would have been very onerous on the Electoral Commission, but they do have a voluntary code of conduct with the various candidates and the social media platforms. So at the moment, it's a voluntary code of conduct. It depends on whether they want to sign up to it or not. There will be stronger powers coming in there legally, that it's not just guidelines. So we are in that space where they're opting in to do the right thing. As we know, 99% of people will opt in to do the right thing. It's that 1% that you might need to watch.
That's right. I think, like everything else, we're in that Wild West territory now, aren't they, where you ask for forgiveness rather than for
it's
permission.
It's not as bad as what would have been there around the time of repeal, where Google and Meta had to just stop taking ads. So we are in a better space. People are more aware of it. I don't think for the locals we're going to see as many issues with AI, purely because the candidates are going to be so busy. But it might be interesting to see what might be coming through with the Europeans, if there's anything coming in there, especially that we still have the broadcast moratorium, but no broadcast moratorium affects online. So we'll have to see how that pans out.
Interesting weeks ahead for us all. Jennifer, thank you so much for taking the time to come in to us today. That is Jennifer Kavanagh, law lecturer at the Southeastern Technical University in Waterford. Thank you. Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the Newstalk app. Next week, we're going to have a special broadcast on the local, European and Limerick mayor election. We'll have top class analysis about what the people of Ireland are really telling their politicians. So do try and join us for that. Thanks to all of today's guests, and thanks to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy. Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on today's items, do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on Newstalk.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.